Penguin Random House Audio presents Rogue Lawyer by John Grisham. Read for you by Mark Deakins. Part 1. Contempt. Chapter 1. My name is Sebastian Rudd, and though I am a well-known street lawyer, you will not see my name on billboards, on bus benches, or screaming at you from the yellow pages. I don't pay to be seen on television, though I am often there. My name is not listed in any phone book. I do not maintain a traditional office. I carry a gun, legally, because my name and face tend to attract attention from the type of people who also carry guns and don't mind using them. I live alone, usually sleep alone, and do not possess the patience and understanding necessary to maintain friendships. The law is my life, always consuming and occasionally fulfilling. I wouldn't call it a jealous mistress, as some forgotten person once so famously did. It's more like an overbearing wife who controls the checkbook. There's no way out. These nights I find myself sleeping in cheap motel rooms that change each week. I'm not trying to save money. Rather, I'm just trying to stay alive. There are plenty of people who'd like to kill me right now, and a few of them have been quite vocal. They don't tell you in law school that one day you may find yourself defending a person charged with a crime so heinous that otherwise peaceful citizens feel driven to take up arms and threaten to kill the accused, his lawyer, and even the judge. But I've been threatened before. It's part of being a rogue lawyer, a subspecialty of the profession that I more or less fell into 10 years ago. When I finished law school, jobs were scarce. I reluctantly took a part-time position in the city's public defender's office. From there, I landed in a small, unprofitable firm that handled only criminal defense. After a few years, that firm blew up, and I was on my own, out on the street with plenty of others, scrambling to make a buck. One case put me on the map. I can't say it made me famous because, seriously, how can you say a lawyer is famous in a city of 1 million people? Plenty of local hacks think they're famous. They smile from billboards as they beg for your bankruptcy and swagger in television ads as they seem deeply concerned about your personal injuries. But they're forced to pay for their own publicity. Not me. The cheap motels change each week. I'm in the middle of a trial in a dismal backwater redneck town called Milo, 2 hours from where I live in the city. I am defending a brain-damaged 18-year-old dropout who's charged with killing 2 little girls in one of the most evil crimes I've ever seen, and I've seen plenty. My clients are almost always guilty, so I don't waste a lot of time wringing my hands about whether they get what they deserve. In this case, though, Gardy is not guilty. Not that it matters. It does not. What's important in Milo these days is that Gardy gets convicted and sentenced to death and executed as soon as possible so that the town can feel better about itself and move on. Move on to where, exactly? Hell if I know. Nor do I care. This place has been moving backward for 50 years, and one lousy verdict will not change its course. I've read and heard it said that Milo needs closure, whatever that means. You'd have to be an idiot to believe this town will somehow grow and prosper and become more tolerant as soon as Gardy gets the needle. My job is layered and complicated, and at the same time, it's quite simple. I'm being paid by the state to provide a first-class defense to a defendant charged with capital murder, and this requires me to fight and claw and raise hell in a courtroom where no one is listening. Gardy was essentially convicted the day he was arrested, and his trial is only a formality. The dumb and desperate cops trumped up the charges and fabricated the evidence. The prosecutor knows this, but has no spine and is up for re-election next year. The judge is asleep. The jurors are basically nice, simple people, wide-eyed at the process and ever so anxious to believe the lies their proud authorities are producing on the witness stand. Milo has its share of cheap motels, but I can't stay there. I would be lynched or flayed or burned at the stake, or if I'm lucky, a sniper would hit me between the eyes and it would be over in a flash. The state police are providing protection during the trial, but I get the clear impression these guys are just not into it. They view me the same way most people do. I'm a long-haired, roguish zealot, sick enough to fight for the rights of child killers and the like. My current motel is a Hampton Inn, located 25 minutes from Milo. It costs $60 a night, and the state will reimburse me. Next door is Partner, a hulking, heavily armed guy who wears black suits and takes me everywhere. Partner is my driver, bodyguard, confidant, paralegal, caddy, and only friend. I earned his loyalty when a jury found him not guilty of killing an undercover narcotics officer. We walked out of the courtroom arm in arm, and have been inseparable ever since. On at least two occasions, off-duty cops have tried to kill him. On one occasion, they came after me. We're still standing. Or perhaps I should say, we're still ducking. Chapter 2. At 8 a.m., Partner knocks on my door. It's time to go. We say our good mornings and climb into my vehicle, which is a large black Ford cargo van, heavily customized for my needs. Since it doubles as an office, the rear seats have been rearranged around a small table that folds into a wall. There is a sofa where I often spend the night. All windows are shaded and bulletproof. It has a television, stereo system, internet, refrigerator, bar, a couple of guns, and a change of clothes. I sit in the front with Partner and we unwrap fast food sausage biscuits as we leave the parking lot. An unmarked state police car moves in front of us for the escort to Milo. There is another one behind us. The last death threat was 2 days ago and came by email. Partner does not speak unless spoken to. I didn't make this rule, but I adore it. He is not the least bit bothered by long gaps in the conversation, nor am I. After years of saying next to nothing, we have learned to communicate with nods and winks and silence. Halfway to Milo, I open a file and start taking notes. The double murder was so gruesome, no local lawyer would touch it. Then Gardy was arrested, and one look at Gardy and you know he's guilty. Long hair dyed jet black, an astonishing collection of piercings above the neck and tattoos below, matching steel earrings, cold, pale eyes, and a smirk that says, "Okay, I did it. Now what?" In its very first story, the Milo newspaper described him as a member of a satanic cult who has a record of molesting children. How's that for honest and unbiased reporting? He was never a member of a satanic cult, and the child molestation thing is not what it seems. But from that moment, Gardy was guilty. And I still marvel at the fact that we've made it this far. They wanted to string him up months ago. Needless to say, every lawyer in Milo locked his door and unplugged her phone. There is no public defender system in the town, it's too small, and the indigent cases are doled out by the judge. There is an unwritten rule that the younger lawyers in town take these low-paying cases because, one, someone has to, and two, the older lawyers did so when they were younger. But no one would agree to defend Gardy, and to be honest, I can't really blame them. It's their town and their lives, and to rub shoulders with such a twisted murderer could do real damage to a career. As a society, we adhere to the belief in a fair trial for a person accused of a serious crime, but some of us struggle when it comes to the business of providing a competent lawyer to guarantee said fair trial. Lawyers like me live with the question, but how do you represent such scum? I offer a quick, "Someone has to," as I walk away. Do we really want fair trials? No, we do not. We want justice, and quickly. And justice is whatever we deem it to be on a case-by-case basis. It's just as well that we don't believe in fair trials because we damn sure don't have them. The presumption of innocence is now the presumption of guilt. The burden of proof is a travesty, because the proof is often lies. Guilt beyond a reasonable doubt means if he probably did it, then let's get him off the streets. At any rate, the lawyers ran for the hills and Gardy had no one. It's a commentary, sad or otherwise, on my reputation that I soon got the phone call. In this end of the state, it is now well known in legal circles that if you can't find anybody else, call Sebastian Rudd. He'll defend anybody. When Gardy was arrested, a mob showed up outside the jail and screamed for justice. When the police perp-walked him to a van for the ride to the courthouse, the mob cursed him and threw tomatoes and rocks. This was thoroughly reported by the local newspaper and even made the city's evening news. There is no network station based in Milo, only a low-end cable outfit. I howled for a change of venue, pleaded with the judge to move the trial at least 100 miles away so we could hopefully find some jurors who hadn't thrown stuff at the kid, or at the least cursed him over dinner. But we were denied. All of my pretrial motions were denied. Again, the town wants justice. The town wants closure. There is no mob to greet me and my van as we pull into a short driveway behind the courthouse, but some of the usual actors are here. They huddle behind a police barricade not far away and hold their sad signs that say such clever things as, "Hang the baby killer," and "Satan is waiting," and "Crud Rudd out of Milo." There are about a dozen of these pathetic souls just waiting to jeer at me and, more important, to show their hatred to Gardy, who will arrive at the same place in about 5 minutes. During the early days of the trial, this little crowd attracted cameras, and a few of these people made it into the newspapers, along with their signs. This, of course, encouraged them, and they've been here every morning since. Fat Susie holds the "Crud Rudd" sign and looks like she wants to shoot me. Bullet Bob claims to be a relative of one of the dead girls and was quoted as saying something to the effect that a trial was a waste of time. He was right about that, I'm afraid. When the van stops, Partner hurries around to my door, where he's met by 3 young deputies about his size. I step out and am properly shielded, then I'm whisked into the rear door of the courthouse as Bullet Bob calls me a whore. Another safe entry. I'm not aware of any case in modern times in which a criminal defense attorney was gunned down while entering a courthouse in the middle of a trial. Nevertheless, I have resigned myself to the likelihood that I could well be the first. We climb a narrow rear staircase that's off limits to everyone else, and I'm led to a small windowless room where they once held prisoners waiting to see the judge. A few minutes later, Gardy arrives in one piece. Partner steps outside and closes the door. "How you doing?" I ask when we are alone. He smiles and rubs his wrists, unshackled for a few hours. "Okay, I guess. Didn't sleep much." He didn't shower either, because he's afraid to shower. He tries it occasionally, but they won't turn on the hot water. So Gardy reeks of stale sweat and dirty sheets, and I'm thankful he's far enough away from the jury. The black dye is slowly leaving his hair, and each day it gets lighter, and his skin gets paler. He's changing colors in front of the jury, another clear sign of his animalistic capabilities and satanic bent. "What's gonna happen today?" he asks, with an almost childlike curiosity. He has an IQ of 70, just barely enough to be prosecuted and put to death. "More of the same, Gardy, I'm afraid. Just more of the same."
"Can't you make them stop lying?"
"No, I cannot." The state has no physical evidence linking Gardy to the murders. Zero. So instead of evaluating its lack of evidence and reconsidering its case, the state is doing what it often does. It's plowing ahead with lies and fabricated testimony. Gardy has spent 2 weeks in the courtroom, listening to the lies, closing his eyes while slowly shaking his head. He's able to shake his head for hours at a time, and the jurors must think he's crazy. I've told him to stop, to sit up, to take a pen and scribble something on a legal pad, as if he has a brain and wants to fight back, to win. But he simply cannot do this, and I cannot argue with my client in the courtroom. I've also told him to cover his arms and neck to hide the tattoos, but he's proud of them. I've told him to lose the piercings, but he insists on being who he is. The bright folks who run the Milo jail forbid piercings of all types, unless, of course, you're guardy and you're headed back to the courtroom. In that case, stick them all over your face. Look as sick and creepy and satanic as possible, guardy, so that your peers will have no trouble with your guilt. On a nail is a hanger with the same white shirt and khaki pants he's worn every day. I paid for this cheap ensemble. He slowly unzips the orange jail jumpsuit and steps out of it. He does not wear underwear, something I noticed the first day of the trial and have tried to ignore since. He slowly gets dressed.
"So much lying," he says.
And he's right. The state has called 19 witnesses so far, and not a single one resisted the temptation to embellish a bit or to lie outright. The pathologist who did the autopsies at the state crime lab told the jury the two little victims had drowned, but he also added that blunt force trauma to their heads was a contributing factor. It's a better story for the prosecution if the jury believes the girls were raped and beaten senseless before being tossed into the pond. There's no physical proof they were in any way sexually molested, but that hasn't stopped the prosecution from making this a part of its case. I haggled with the pathologist for 3 hours, but it's tough arguing with an expert, even an incompetent one. Since the state has no evidence, it is forced to manufacture some. The most outrageous testimony came from a jailhouse snitch they call Smut, an appropriate nickname. Smut is an accomplished courtroom liar who testifies all the time and will say whatever the prosecutors want him to say. In Gardy's case, Smut was back in jail on a drug charge and looking at 10 years in prison. The cops needed some testimony, and not surprisingly, Smut was at their disposal. They fed him details of the crimes, then transferred Gardy from a regional jail to a county jail, where Smut was locked up. Gardy had no idea why he was being transferred and had no clue that he was walking into a trap. This happened before I got involved. They threw Gardy into a small cell with Smut, who was anxious to talk and wanted to help in any way. He claimed to hate cops and know some good lawyers. He'd also read about the murders of the two girls and had a hunch he knew who really killed them. Since Gardy knew nothing about the murders, he had nothing to add to the conversation. Nonetheless, within 24 hours, Smut claimed he'd heard a full confession. The cops yanked him out of the cell, and Gardy never saw him again until trial. As a witness, Smut cleaned up nicely, wore a shirt and tie and short hair, and hid his tattoos from the jury. In amazing detail, he replayed Gardy's account of how he stalked the two girls into the woods, knocked them off their bikes, gagged and bound them, then tortured, molested, and beat them before tossing them into the pond. In Smut's version, Gardy was high on drugs and had been listening to heavy metal. It was quite a performance. I knew it was all a lie, as did Gardy and Smut, along with the cops and prosecutors, and I suspect the judge had his doubts too. Nevertheless, the jurors swallowed it in disgust and glared with hatred at my client, who absorbed it with his eyes closed and his head shaking, "No, no, no." Smut's testimony was so breathtakingly gruesome and rich with details that it was hard to believe, at times, that he was really fabricating it. No one can lie like that. I hammered at Smut for 8 full hours, one long, exhausting day. The judge was cranky and the jurors were bleary-eyed, but I could have kept going for a week. I asked Smut how many times he'd testified in criminal trials. He said maybe twice. I pulled out the records, refreshed his memory, and went through the 9 other trials in which he'd performed the same miracle for our honest and fair-minded prosecutors. With his muddled memory somewhat restored, I asked him how many times he'd had his sentence reduced by the prosecutors after lying for them in court. He said never, so I went through each of the 9 cases again. I produced the paperwork.
I made it perfectly clear to everyone, especially the jurors, that Smut was a lying, serial snitch who swapped bogus testimony for leniency. I confess, I get angry in court, and this is often detrimental. I blew my cool with Smut and hammered him so relentlessly that some of the jurors became sympathetic. The judge finally told me to move on, but I didn't. I hate liars, especially those who swear to tell the truth and then fabricate testimony to convict my client. I yelled at Smut, and the judge yelled at me, and at times it seemed as though everyone was yelling. This did not help Gardy's cause. You would think the prosecutor might break up his parade of liars with a credible witness, but this would require some intelligence. His next witness was another inmate, another druggie who testified he was in the hallway near Gardy's cell and heard him confess to Smut. Lies on top of lies. "Please make them stop," Gardy says. "I'm trying, Gardy. I'm doing the best I can. We need to go." Chapter 3. A deputy leads us into the courtroom, which is again packed with people and heavy with a layer of tense apprehension. This is the 10th day of testimony, and I now believe there is absolutely nothing else happening in this backwater town. We are the entertainment. The courtroom is packed from gavel to gavel, and they're lined up against the walls. Thank God the weather is cool, or we'd all be soaked with sweat. Every capital murder trial requires the presence of at least two lawyers for the defense. My co-counsel, or second chair, is Trotz, a thick, dull boy who ought to burn his law license and curse the day he ever dreamed of showing his face in a courtroom. He's from a small town 20 miles away, far enough, he thought, to shield him from the unpleasantness of getting caught up in Gardy's nightmare. Trotz volunteered to handle the preliminary matters, intending to jump ship if a trial became a reality. His plans have not worked out to suit him. He screwed up the preliminaries as only a rookie can, then tried to extricate himself. "No go," said the judge. Trotz then thought it might be an acceptable idea to sit in the second chair, gain some experience, feel the pressure of a real trial, and so on. But after several death threats, he stopped trying. Death threats are just part of the daily grind for me, like the morning coffee and lying cops. I've filed 3 motions to remove Trotz from the second chair. All denied, of course. So Gardy and I are stuck with a moron at our table who's more of a hindrance than an assistant. Trotz sits as far away as possible, though given Gardy's current state of hygiene, I can't really blame him. Gardy told me months ago that when he was first interviewed by Trotz at the county jail, the lawyer was shocked when Gardy claimed he was innocent. They even argued about it. How's that for a vigorous defender? So Trotz sits at the end of the table, his head buried in useless note-taking, his eyes seeing nothing, his ears hearing nothing, but he feels the stares of all those sitting behind us who hate us and want to string us up with our client. Trotz figures this too shall pass, and he'll get on with his life and career the moment the trial is over. He is wrong. As soon as possible, I'll file an ethics complaint with the State Bar Association, alleging Trotz provided ineffective assistance of counsel before and during the trial. I've done this before, and I know how to make it stick. I'm fighting my own battles with the bar, and I understand the game. After I get finished with Trotz, he'll want to surrender his license and get a job at a used car lot. Gardy takes his seat in the middle of our table. Trotz does not look at his client, nor does he speak. Hoover, the prosecutor, walks over and hands me a sheet of paper. There are no good mornings or hellos. We are so far beyond even the most benign pleasantries that a civilized grunt from either of us would be a surprise. I loathe this man the way he loathes me, but I have an advantage in the hating game. Almost monthly, I deal with self-righteous prosecutors who lie, cheat, stonewall, cover up, ignore ethics, and do whatever it takes to get a conviction, even when they know the truth and the truth tells them they are wrong. So I know the breed, the ilk, the subclass of lawyer who's above the law because he is the law. Hoover, on the other hand,
rarely deals with a rogue like me because, sadly for him, he doesn't see many sensational cases, and almost none in which a defendant shows up with a pit bull for a protector. If he dealt with rabid defense lawyers more regularly, he might be more adept at hating us. For me, it's a way of life. I take the sheet of paper and say, "So, who's your liar of the day?" He says nothing and walks a few feet back to his table, where his little gang of assistants huddle importantly in their dark suits and ham it up for the home crowd. They are on display in this, the biggest show of their miserable backwater careers, and I often get the impression that everyone from the DA's office who can walk, talk, wear a cheap suit, and carry a new briefcase is packed around the table to ensure justice. The bailiff barks. I stand. Judge Kaufman enters. Then we sit. Gardy refuses to stand in homage to the great man. Initially, this really pissed off his honor. On the first day of trial, it now seems like months ago, he snapped at me, "Mr. Rudd, would you please ask your client to stand?" I did, and he refused. This embarrassed the judge, and we discussed it later in his chambers. He threatened to hold my client in contempt and keep him in jail all day long during the trial. I tried to encourage this, but let it slip that such an overreaction would be mentioned repeatedly on appeal. Gardy wisely observed, "What can they do to me that they haven't already done?" So each morning, Judge Kaufman begins the ceremonies with a long, nasty scowl at my client, who's usually slouched in his chair, either picking at his nose ring or nodding with his eyes closed. It's impossible to tell which one of us, lawyer or client, Kaufman despises the most. Like the rest of Milo, he's been convinced for a long time that Gardy is guilty. And like everybody else in the courtroom, he has loathed me from day one. Doesn't matter. In this line of work, you rarely have allies, and you quickly make enemies. Since he's up for re-election next year, as is Hoover, Kaufman slaps on his phony politician's smile and welcomes everyone to his courtroom for another interesting day in the pursuit of the truth. Based on the calculations I made one day during lunch when the courtroom was empty, there are about 310 people sitting behind me. Except for Gardy's mother and sister, everyone is fervently praying for a conviction, with a quick execution to follow. It's up to Judge Kaufman to deliver. This is the judge who has so far allowed every word of bogus testimony offered by the state. At times, it seems as though he's afraid he might lose a vote or two if he sustains one of my objections. When everyone is in place, they bring in the jury. There are 14 people crammed in the box, the chosen 12 plus a couple of alternates in case someone gets sick or does something wrong. They are not sequestered, though I requested this, so they are free to go home at night and trash Gardy and me over dinner. Late each afternoon, they are warned by His Honor not to utter a single word about the case, but you can almost hear them yakking as they drive away. Their decision has been made. If they voted right now, before we offer a single witness in defense, they would find him guilty and demand his execution. Then they would return home as heroes and talk about this trial for the rest of their lives. When Gardy gets the needle, they will take special pride in their crucial role in finding justice. They will be elevated in Milo. They will be congratulated, stopped on the streets, recognized at church. Still sappy, Kaufman welcomes them back, thanks them for their civic service, asks gravely whether anyone tried to contact them in an effort to gain influence. This usually prompts a few looks in my direction, as if I have the time, energy, and stupidity to slink around the streets of Milo at night, stalking these same jurors so I can, 1, bribe them, 2, intimidate them, or 3, plead with them. It's now gospel that I'm the only crook in the room, in spite of the torrent of sins committed by the other side. The truth is, if I had the money, the time, and the personnel, I would bribe and/or intimidate every juror. When the state, with its limitless resources, commences a fraudulent case and cheats at every turn, then cheating is legitimized. There is no level playing field. There is no fairness. The only honorable alternative for a lawyer fighting to save an innocent client is to cheat in defense. However, if a defense lawyer is caught cheating, he or she gets nailed with sanctions by the court, reprimanded by the State Bar Association, maybe even indicted. If a prosecutor gets caught cheating, he either gets re-elected or elevated to the bench. Our system never holds a bad prosecutor accountable. The jurors assure His Honor that all is well.
"Mr. Hoover," he announces with great solemnity, "please call your next witness."
Next up for the state is a fundamentalist preacher who converted the old Chrysler dealership into the World Harvest Temple and is drawing crowds to his daily prayer-a-thons. I watched him once on local cable. Once is enough. His claim to fame here is that he says he confronted Gardy in the middle of a late-night youth service. According to his version, Gardy was wearing a T-shirt advertising a heavy metal rock group and conveying some vague satanic message, and this T-shirt was allowing the devil to infiltrate the service. Spiritual warfare was in the air, and God was unhappy with things. With divine direction, the preacher finally located the source of evil in the crowd, stopped the music, stormed back to where Gardy was sitting, and kicked him out of the building. Gardy says he's never been near the church. Further, Gardy claims he's never seen the inside of any church in all of his 18 years. His mother confirms this. As they say out here in the country, Gardy's family is severely unchurched. Why this is allowed as testimony in a capital murder case is thoroughly inconceivable. It is ridiculous and borders on stupidity. Assuming there is a conviction, all of this crap will be reviewed in about 2 years by a dispassionate appellate court 200 miles away. Those judges, only slightly more intelligent than Kaufman, but anything is an improvement, will take a dim view of this redneck preacher telling his trumped-up story about an altercation that supposedly took place some 13 months before the murders. I object. Overruled. I object angrily. I'm overruled. Angrily. Hoover, though, is desperate to keep Satan involved in his theory of the case. Judge Kaufman opened the gates days ago, and anything is welcome. However, he'll slam them as soon as I start calling witnesses. We'll be lucky to get 100 words into the record. The preacher has an unpaid tax bill in another state. He doesn't know I've found it, and thus we'll have some fun on cross-examination. Not that it will matter. It will not. This jury is done. Gardy is a monster who deserves to go to hell. Their job is to speed him along. He leans over long enough to whisper,
"Mr. Rudd, I swear I've never been to church."
I nod and smile because this is all I can do. A defense lawyer cannot always believe his clients, but when Gardy says he's never been to church, I believe him. The preacher has a temper, and I soon stoke it. I use the unpaid tax bill to really irritate him, and once he's pissed, he stays that way. I lead him into arguments over the inerrancy of Scripture, the Trinity, the Apocalypse, speaking in tongues, playing with snakes, drinking poison, and the pervasiveness of satanic cults in the Milo area. Hoover yells objections, and Kaufman sustains them. At one point, the preacher, pious and red-faced, closes his eyes and raises both hands as high as possible. Instinctively, I freeze and cower and look at the ceiling as if a lightning bolt is coming. Later, he calls me an atheist and says I'm going to hell. "So you have the authority to send folks to hell," I fire back. "God tells me you're going to hell." "Then put him on the loudspeaker so we can all hear." Two jurors actually chuckle at this. Kaufman has had enough. He raps the gavel and calls for lunch. We've wasted the morning with this sanctimonious little prick and his bogus testimony, but he's not the first local to wedge himself into the trial. The town is filled with wannabe heroes. Chapter 4. Lunch is always a treat. Since it's not safe to leave the courthouse, actually the courtroom itself, Gardy and I eat a sandwich by ourselves at the defense table. It's the same box lunch fed to the jurors. They bring in 16 of them, mix them up, draw R's at random, and take the rest to the jury room. This was my idea, because I prefer not to be poisoned. Guardy has no clue. He's just hungry. He says the food at the jail is what you'd expect, and he doesn't trust the guards. He eats nothing there, and since he's surviving only on lunch, I asked Judge Kaufman if the county could perhaps double up and give the boy 2 rubber chicken sandwiches with extra chips and another pickle. In other words, 2 box lunches instead of 1. Denied. So, Guardy gets half of my sandwich and all of my kosher dill. If I weren't starving, he could have the entire box of crap. Partner comes and goes throughout the day. He's afraid to leave our van in one spot due to the high probability of slashed tires and cracked windows. He also has a few responsibilities, one of which is to meet occasionally with the bishop. In these cases where I'm called into a combat zone, into a small town that has already closed ranks and is ready to kill one of its own for some heinous crime, it takes a while to find a contact. This contact is always another lawyer, a local who also defends criminals and butts heads weekly with the police and prosecutors. This contact reaches out eventually, quietly, afraid of being exposed as a traitor. He knows the truth, or something close to it. He knows the players, the bad actors, and the occasional good one. Since his survival depends on getting along with the cops and court clerks and assistant prosecutors, he knows the system. In Guardy's case, my deep-throated pal is Jimmy Bressup. We call him the Bishop. I've never met him. He works through Partner, and they meet in strange places. Partner says he's about 60 with long, thinning gray hair, bad clothes, a loud, foul mouth, an abrasive nature, and a weakness for the bottle. An older version of me? I asked. Not quite, came the wise reply. For all his bluster and big talk, the bishop is afraid of getting too close to Guardy's lawyers. The bishop says Hoover and his gang know by now they've got the wrong guy, but have too much invested to stop and admit their mistakes. He says there have been whispers from day one about the real killer. Chapter 5. It's Friday, and everyone in the courtroom is exhausted. I spend an hour haranguing a pimply, stupid little brat who claims he was at the same church service when Guardy called forth the demons and disrupted things. Honestly, I've seen the worst of bogus courtroom evidence, but I've never seen anything as bad as this. In addition to being false, it is wholly irrelevant. No other prosecutor would bother with it. No other judge would admit it. Kaufman finally announces an adjournment for the weekend. Guardy and I meet in the holding room where he changes into his jail uniform while I offer banalities about having a good weekend. I give him $10 for the vending machines. He says tomorrow his mother will bring him lemon cookies, his favorite. Sometimes the guards pass them through, sometimes they keep them for their own nourishment. One never knows. The guards average 300 pounds each, so I guess they need the stolen calories. I tell Guardy to take a shower over the weekend and wash his hair. He says, "Mr. Rudd, if I find a razor, I'm gone." With an index finger, he does a slashing motion against his wrist. "Don't say that, Guardy." He's said it before, and he means it. The kid has nothing to live for, and he's smart enough to see what's coming. Hell, a blind man could see it. We shake hands, and I hurry down the back steps. Partner and the deputies meet me at the rear door and shove me into our vehicle. Another safe exit. Outside Milo, I begin to nod and soon fall asleep. 10 minutes later, my phone vibrates and I answer it. We follow the state trooper back to our motel, where we grab our luggage and check out. Soon we are alone and headed for the city. "Did you see the bishop?" I ask Partner.
"Oh, yes. It's Friday, and I think he starts drinking around noon on Friday. But beer only," he's quick to point out. "So I bought a 6-pack and we drove around. The joint is a real dive out east, just beyond the city limits. He says Peely is a regular. So you've had a few beers already? Should I be driving?
Only one, boss. I sipped it until it was warm. The bishop, on the other hand, took his cold. Three of them.
And we believe this guy?
I'm just doing my job. On the one hand, he has credibility because he's lived here all his life and knows everyone. On the other, he's so full of crap you want to dismiss everything he says. We'll see.
I close my eyes and try to nap. Sleep is virtually impossible in the midst of a capital murder trial, and I've learned to grab it whenever possible. I've stolen 10 minutes on a hard bench in an empty courtroom during lunch, just as I've paced back and forth in a dingy motel room at 3 in the morning. I often black out mid-sentence when partner drives and the van hums along. At some point, as we head back to our version of civilization, I fade away. Chapter 6. It's the third Friday of the month, and I have a standing date, if you'd call 2 drinks a real date. It feels more like an appointment for a root canal. The truth is, this woman wouldn't date me at gunpoint, and the feelings are so mutual. But we have a history. We meet at the same bar, in the same booth where we had our first meal together, in another lifetime. Nostalgia has nothing to do with it. It's all about convenience. It's a corporate bar downtown, one of a chain, but the ambiance is not bad and it's lively on Friday evenings. Judith Whitley arrives first and gets the booth. I slide in a few minutes later just as she's about to get irritated. She has never been late for anything and views tardiness as a sign of weakness. In her opinion, I possess many of these signs. She, too, is a lawyer. That's how we met.
"You look tired," she says, without a trace of compassion.
She, too, is showing signs of fatigue, though at 39 she is still strikingly beautiful. Every time I see her, I'm reminded of why I fell so hard.
"Thank you, and you look great, as always."
"Thanks."
10 days and we're all running out of gas.
"Any luck?"
she asks.
"Not yet."
She knows the basics of Gardy's case and trial, and she knows me. If I believe the kid is innocent, that's good enough for her. But she has her own clients to fret and lose sleep over. We order drinks, her standard Friday night glass of Chardonnay and my whiskey sour. We'll have 2 drinks in less than an hour. Then that's it for another month.
"How's Starcher?" I ask.
I keep hoping that one day I can pronounce my son's name without hating it, but that day has not arrived. My name is on his birth certificate as the father, but I wasn't around when he was born. Therefore, Judith had control over the name. It should be someone's last name, if it has to be used at all.
"He's doing well,"
she says smugly, because she's thoroughly involved with the kid's life and I am not.
"I met with his teacher last week, and she's pleased with his progress. She says he's just a normal second grader who's reading at a high level and enjoying life."
"That's good to hear," I say. Normal is the key word here because of our history. Starcher is not being raised the normal way. He spends half his time with Judith and her current partner, and the other half with her parents. From the hospital, she took Starcher to an apartment she shared with Gwyneth, the woman she left me for. They then spent 3 years trying to legally adopt Starcher, but I fought them like a rabid animal. I have nothing against gay couples adopting kids. I just couldn't stand Gwyneth. And I was right. They split not long afterward in a nasty fight, one I enjoyed immensely from deep in left field. It gets more complicated. The drinks arrive, and we don't bother with a polite cheers. That would only waste time. We need the alcohol ASAP. I deliver the awful news by saying, "My mother is coming to town next weekend, and she'd like to see Starcher. He is, after all, her only grandson."
"I know that," she snaps. "It's your weekend. You can do what you want."
"True, but you have a way of complicating everything.
I just don't want any trouble, that's all." "Your mother is nothing but trouble."
Truer words were never spoken, and I nod in defeat.
It would be a dramatic understatement to say that Judith and my mother hated each other from the opening bell. So much so that my mother informed me she would cut me out of her last will and testament if I married Judith. At the time, I was secretly having some serious doubts about our romance and our future, but that threat was the last straw. Though I expect Mom to live to be 100, her estate will be a delight. A guy with my income needs a dream. A subplot in this sad story is that my mother often uses her will to bully her children. My sister married a Republican and got herself cut out of the will. 2 years later, the Republican, who's really a nice guy, became the father of the most perfect granddaughter in history. Now my sister is back in the will, or so we think. Anyway, I was preparing to break up with Judith when she gave me the crushing news that she was pregnant. I assumed I was the father, though I didn't ask that loaded question. Later, I learned the brutal truth that she was already seeing Gwyneth. Talk about a shot to the gut. I'm sure there were clues that my dearly beloved was actually a lesbian, but I missed every one of them. We got married. Mom said she changed her will and I would not get a penny. We lived together off and on for 5 wretched months, were technically married for 15 more, and split to save our sanity. Starcher arrived in the middle of the war, a casualty from birth, and we've been sniping at each other ever since. This ritual of meeting once a month for drinks is our homage to forced civility. I think I'm back in my dear mother's will. "And what does Mummy plan to do with my child?" she asks. It's never our child. She has never been able to resist the little digs, the sophomoric cheap shots. She picks at the scabs, but not even in a clever way. It's almost impossible to ignore, but I've learned to bite my tongue. My tongue has scars. I think they're going to the zoo.
She always takes him to the zoo.
What's the harm in going to the zoo?
Well, last time he had nightmares about pythons.
Okay, I'll ask her to take him somewhere else. She's already causing trouble. What could be wrong with taking a fairly normal 7-year-old boy to the zoo? I don't know why we meet like this. How are things around the firm? I ask, my curiosity similar to that of watching a car wreck. It's irresistible.
Fine, she says. The usual turmoil.
You need some boys in that firm.
We have enough problems.
The waiter notices both glasses are empty and goes for another round. The first drinks always disappear fast. Judith is one of 4 partners in a firm of 10 women, all militant lesbians. The firm specializes in gay law, discrimination in employment, housing, education, health care, and the latest, gay divorce. They're good lawyers, tough negotiators and litigators, always on the attack and often in the news. The firm projects an image of being at war with society and never backing down. The outside fights, though, are far less colorful than the inside brawls. I could join as the senior partner, I say in an effort at levity.
You wouldn't last 10 minutes.
No man would last 10 minutes in their offices. In fact, men avoid them zealously. Mention the name of her firm and men run for the hills. Fine fellows caught screwing around jump off bridges. You're probably right. Do you ever miss sex with the opposite sex?
Seriously, Sebastian, you want to talk about straight sex after a bad marriage and an unwanted child?
I like straight sex. Did you ever like it? You seemed to.
I was faking.
You were not. You were pretty wonderful, as I recall. I know 2 guys who slept with her before I came along. Then she ran to Gwyneth. I've often wondered if I was so lousy in bed that I drove her to switch teams. I doubt it. I must say, she has a good eye. I loathed Gwyneth, still do, but the woman could stop traffic on any street in town. And her current partner, Ava, once modeled lingerie for a local department store. I remember her ads in the Sunday newspaper. The second drinks arrive and we grab them.
If you want to talk about sex, I'm leaving, she says, but she's not angry.
I'm sorry. Look, Judith, Every time I see you, I think about sex. My problem, not yours.
Get help.
I don't need help. I need sex.
Are you propositioning me?
Would it do any good?
No.
Didn't think so.
You have fights tonight?
She asks, changing the subject, and I don't resist. I do.
You're sick, you know. That's such a brutal sport.
Starcher says he wants to go.
You take Starcher to the cage fights, and you'll never see him again.
Relax.
I'm just joking. You may be joking, but you're still sick.
Thank you. Have another drink. A shapely Asian in a short, tight skirt walks by, and we both have a look. Dibs, I say. The alcohol kicks in. It takes longer for her because she is naturally wound tighter, and Judith manages a grin, the first of the evening. Could be the first of the week.
Are you seeing anyone?
She asks, her tone noticeably softer. Not since we last met, I say. It's been all work. My last girlfriend said goodbye 3 years ago. I get lucky occasionally, but I'd be lying if I said I was on the prowl for a serious woman. There is a long, heavy gap in the conversation as we get bored. When we're down to the last few drops of our drinks, we go back to Starcher and my mother and the next weekend that we both now dread. We walk together out of the bar, dutifully peck each other on the cheek, and say goodbye. Another box checked off. I loved her once. Then I truly hated her. Now I almost like Judith, and if we can continue these monthly meetings, we might become friends. That's my goal, because I really need a friend. One who can understand what I do and why I do it. And it would be much better for our son, too.
Chapter 7.
I live on the 25th floor of a downtown apartment building with a partial view of the river. I like it up here because it's quiet and safe. If someone wanted to bomb or burn my apartment, it would be difficult without taking down the entire building. There is some crime downtown, so we live with plenty of video surveillance and guards with guns. I feel secure. They fired bullets into my old apartment, a duplex on the ground floor, and they firebombed my old office 5 years ago. They have never been found or identified, and I get the clear impression the cops aren't looking that hard. As I said, my line of work inspires hatred, and there are people out there who'd love to see me suffer. Some of these people hide behind badges. The apartment has 1,000 square feet with 2 small bedrooms, an even smaller kitchen, seldom used, and a living area that's barely big enough to hold my only substantial piece of furniture. I'm not sure a vintage pool table should be classified as furniture, but it's my apartment and I'll call it what I want. It's 9 feet long, regulation size, and was built in 1884 by the Oliver L. Briggs Company in Boston. I won it in a lawsuit, had it perfectly restored and then carefully reassembled smack in the middle of my den. On an average day, or when I'm not away in cheap motels dodging death threats, I rack 'em up time after time and practice for hours. Shooting pool against myself is an escape, a stress reliever, and cheap therapy. It's also a throwback to my high school days when I hung out at a place called The Rack, a real local dive that's been around for decades. It's an old-fashioned pool hall with rows of tables, layers of smoke, spittoons, cheap beer, some petty gambling, and a clientele that acts tough but knows how to behave. The owner, Curly, is an old friend who's always there and keeps it running smoothly. When the insomnia hits and my walls are closing in, I can often be found at The Rack at 2 in the morning playing 9-ball alone, in another world and quite happy. Not tonight, though. I glide into the apartment, floating on the whiskey, and quickly change into my fight clothes, jeans, a black t-shirt, and a bright, shiny yellow jacket that snaps at the waist, practically glows in the dark, and screams, "Tadeo Zapata," across the back. I pull my slightly graying hair into a tight ponytail, and stuff it under the t-shirt. I change glasses and select a pair rimmed in light blue. I adjust my cap, also a bright yellow that matches the jacket, with the name Zapata across the front. I feel sufficiently disguised, and the evening should go well. Where I'm going, the crowd is not interested in misfit lawyers. There will be a lot of thugs there, a lot of folks with legal troubles past, present, and future, but they'll never notice me. It's another sad fact of my life that I often leave the apartment after dark with some sort of disguise, different cap, glasses, hidden hair, even a fedora. Partner drives me to the old city auditorium 8 blocks from my apartment and drops me off in an alley near the building. A crowd is swarming out front. Loud rap booms across the front plaza. Spotlights sweep maniacally from building to building. Bright digital signs advertise the main event and the undercard. Tadeo fights fourth, the last warm-up before the main event, which tonight is a heavyweight contest that is selling tickets because the favorite is a crazy ex-NFL player who's well known in the area. I own 25% of Tadeo's career, an investment that cost me $30,000 a year ago, and he hasn't lost since. I'm also betting on the side and doing quite well. If he wins tonight, his cut will be $6,000. Half of that if he loses. In a hallway somewhere deep under the arena, I hear 2 security guards talking. One is claiming the evening is a sellout. 5,000 fans. I flash my credentials and get waved through another door, then another. I enter the dark locker room and the tension hits like a brick. Tonight, we're assigned to one half of a long room.